listening test. You will hear a number of different recordings, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be time for you to read the instructions and questions. And you'll have time to check your work. At the start of each recording you'll hear this sound. You will hear each recording twice. You'll be given 2 minutes to check your answers. Part 1. You're going to listen to the recording. Before you listen, you'll have 20 seconds to read the instruction carefully. And you'll listen to the piece twice.
Humanity has confronted countless crises, and many have led to profound and sometimes unexpected change. It was the economist Milton Friedman who once said, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change." But what kind of change can we expect in the aftermath of the coronavirus pandemic? And will it be change for the better? History may give us some answers. By the summer of 1349, the Black Death had killed nearly 50% of the population of England. There was a second wave of the plague in 1361, which killed another 20%. A disaster, yes, but the plague did something which had begun to look impossible. It stopped the 100 Years' War, the series of bloody conflicts between England and France. There was also a profound labour shortage because so many people had died, which put those who survived in a stronger position. Eventually, the exploitative feudal system, under which peasants swore allegiance to lords in exchange for a patch of land and some protection, collapsed. Fast forward to 1918, and another devastating wave of disease was sweeping the world. The so-called Spanish flu, although it didn't actually come from Spain, spread through crowded troop transports and munitions factories towards the end of the First World War. By the end of the pandemic, more than 50 million people had died. But it did give rise to a new understanding of infectious diseases. And that spurred the development of public health systems across the developed world, as scientists and governments realised that the best defence against pandemics was at a societal rather than an individual level. Calls for a unified medical service in the UK date back even earlier, but it wasn't until after the Second World War, in 1948, that Britain's National Health Service was launched. According to the NHS's official historian, Charles Webster, the Luftwaffe achieved in months what had defeated politicians and planners for at least 2 decades. We only gave you part of Milton Friedman's famous quote earlier. He went on to say, "When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around." As well as the launch of free universal healthcare in the UK, the post-war period saw the adoption of other radical ideas that were lying around at the time, including the rapid nationalisation of industry and the creation of the modern welfare state. Globally, institutions such as the United Nations were set up, determined to prevent future wars through international cooperation and diplomacy. Will the aftermath of coronavirus leave us with similarly fertile ground in which new ideas might flourish? Will it kickstart new ways of living, working, travelling? Or make us think again about our attitudes to consumption or our responsibilities to one another? Will ideas such as universal basic income, virtual education, or even healthcare delivered by robots become logical next steps in a profoundly altered world? Or will we pick up where we left off as if nothing had happened? And if there is to be change, who will decide if it's change for the better? After all, not all the ideas lying around will prove to be the right ones.
Now you'll hear the recording again.
Humanity has confronted countless crises, and many have led to profound and sometimes unexpected change. It was the economist Milton Friedman who once said, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change." But what kind of change can we expect in the aftermath of the coronavirus pandemic? And will it be change for the better? History may give us some answers. By the summer of 1349, the Black Death had killed nearly 50% of the population of England. There was a second wave of the plague in 1361, which killed another 20%. A disaster, yes, but the plague did something which had begun to look impossible. It stopped the 100 Years' War, the series of bloody conflicts between England and France. There was also a profound labour shortage because so many people had died, which put those who survived in a stronger position. Eventually, the exploitative feudal system, under which peasants swore allegiance to lords in exchange for a patch of land and some protection, collapsed. Fast forward to 1918, and another devastating wave of disease was sweeping the world. The so-called Spanish flu, although it didn't actually come from Spain, spread through crowded troop transports and munitions factories towards the end of the First World War. By the end of the pandemic, more than 50 million people had died. But it did give rise to a new understanding of infectious diseases. And that spurred the development of public health systems across the developed world, as scientists and governments realized that the best defense against pandemics was at a societal rather than an individual level. Calls for a unified medical service in the UK date back even earlier, but it wasn't until after the Second World War, in 1948, that Britain's National Health Service was launched. According to the NHS's official historian, Charles Webster, the Luftwaffe achieved in months what had defeated politicians and planners for at least two decades. We only gave you part of Milton Friedman's famous quote earlier. He went on to say, "When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around." As well as the launch of free universal healthcare in the UK, the post-war period saw the adoption of other radical ideas that were lying around at the time, including the rapid nationalisation of industry and the creation of the modern welfare state. Globally, institutions such as the United Nations were set up, determined to prevent future wars through international cooperation and diplomacy. Will the aftermath of coronavirus leave us with similarly fertile ground in which new ideas might flourish? Will it kickstart new ways of living, working, travelling? Or make us think again about our attitudes to consumption or our responsibilities to one another? Will ideas such as universal basic income, virtual education, or even healthcare delivered by robots become logical next steps in a profoundly altered world? Or will we pick up where we left off as if nothing had happened? And if there is to be change, who will decide if it's change for the better? After all, not all the ideas lying around will prove to be the right ones.
Part 2. You're going to listen to another recorded material. Again, before you listen, you have 20 seconds to read the instructions carefully, and you will listen to it twice.
But can we really feed a population of 9 billion people, which we will have by 2050? And it'll peak, according to the United Nations median projection, at about 9.2, 9.3 in about 2070. But can we really feed that number of people? Well, at the moment, we need a large proportion of the Earth to feed 6.9 billion people. So if we add another 2 billion people and we enable them to eat chickens and pigs and all these things we like to eat, then we're going to need a lot more land. Now, it would be nice to do all this organically, but the problem with that is we're going to need a lot more land for the cattle whose manure is going to be used as fertilizer, etc. So we're going to need even more land. If we were using the mostly organic farming technologies of the 1950s today, we would need approximately twice as much land to produce the same amount of food as we produce today. So let's not do that. And let's treble yields. If we treble yields in farming, we could actually feed 9 billion people from a smaller acreage than we feed 6.9 billion today. So can we treble yields? Well, we've just done it. In the last 60 years, we trebled yields. This is the yields of rice, wheat, and maize, the big three cereal crops, which provide about 60% of human calories. And they trebled over that time, despite taking effectively no extra acres under the plow. Nobody thought this could be done. We were told repeatedly throughout this period by environmentalists such as Lester Brown that it could not be done, and yet it was done. And how was it done? It was done by getting dwarfing genes into wheat so that they put more of their energy into seeds rather than stalks. It was done by the use of machinery and chemicals and fertilizers and all these things that raised yields in farming.
Now listen again.
But can we really feed a population of 9 billion people, which we will have by 2050? And it'll peak, according to the United Nations median projection, at about 9.2, 9.3 in about 2070. But can we really feed that number of people? Well, at the moment, We need a large proportion of the earth to feed 6.9 billion people. So if we add another 2 billion people and we enable them to eat chickens and pigs and all these things we like to eat, then we're going to need a lot more land. Now, it would be nice to do all this organically, but the problem with that is we're going to need a lot more land for the cattle whose manure is going to be used as fertilizer, etc., so we're going to need even more land. If we were using the mostly organic farming technologies of the 1950s today, we would need approximately twice as much land to produce the same amount of food as we produce today. So let's not do that. And let's treble yields. If we treble yields in farming, we could actually feed 9 billion people from a smaller acreage than we feed 6.9 billion today. So can we treble yields? Well, we've just done it. In the last 60 years, we trebled yields. This is the yields of rice, wheat, and maize, the big three cereal crops, which provide about 60% of human calories. And they trebled over that time, despite taking effectively no extra acres under the plow. Nobody thought this could be done. We were told repeatedly throughout this period by environmentalists such as Lester Brown that it could not be done, and yet it was done. And how was it done? It was done by getting dwarfing genes into wheat so that they put more of their energy into seeds rather than stalks. It was done by the use of machinery and chemicals and fertilizers and all these things that raised yields in farming.
Part 3. You will hear part of a discussion in which a developer, Faye Manier, and an environmentalist, Peter Green, talk about a new government-run trial. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C, or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part 3.
As the global population grows, a greater strain is being put on the planet to provide for humankind. Very often, the struggle to improve standards of living results in having to decide whether to exploit an area of natural beauty for its resources or leave nature alone. Here to discuss the issue of money versus the environment are developer Faye Manier and environmentalist Peter Green. Faye, could you tell us how you can put a price on the environment?
First of all, I'd like to establish a level playing field for this discussion by dispelling the notion that developers are the ruthless, insensitive individuals portrayed in the media. I think that the newly announced government plans to put a price on wildlife clearly shows that developers are now considered responsible, and the idea that developers just want to use nature for their own ends is definitely a thing of the past. The initial trial will involve 6 local authorities putting a price of, say, 40 conservation credits on every 10 homes developed. Each credit could be worth £2,500, making a total of £100,000 to a broker who commissions another landowner to convert fields or scrublands into meadows or woodlands to offset the developed land. The remaining money is then paid to this landowner to maintain wildlife for 2 to 3 decades.
I'm afraid I'm a lot less enthusiastic about the government plan than you are. The plan has been drawn up without sufficient research into the type of artificial environment that would substitute for the site torn up by developers. How, for example, can you think it's acceptable to tear down existing woodland? One would have to wait at least a decade for new woods to grow to be considered a replacement. In fact, it is highly unlikely that any artificial environment will be able to support as many different species as one that has developed naturally. I really feel that the whole idea of creating a new currency in the form of the conservation credit is simply a way for developers to evade planning rules and to gain access to prime greenfield sites so that they can make huge profits.
I think you're missing the point of the proposal trials. We shouldn't need to choose between either improving the environment or growing the economy. We should aim to do both, and these trials should lead to ways of achieving this. And it is not simply a case of satisfying the wants of developers, as you have suggested. It is more a case of meeting needs. There is a parallel in Brazil, where near the town of Carjás, in the middle of the Amazon jungle, lies a vast iron ore mine. From the profits raised, the quality of life for the residents of Rio's favelas or slum areas has been improved. 20 years ago, these slums were neglected because they weren't considered important. Now, perhaps because of global attention being drawn to Rio de Janeiro through sporting events, improving the reputation of the city is top of the agenda. It's a case of moving with the times.
But this comes at a cost. Once a specific environment has been developed, there is no going back. Species disappear. England is losing its wildlife at an alarming rate. Every taxa of birds, butterflies and bees has declined by around 40%. And the country has lost 500 species in the last 200 years. With these trials, losses would accelerate substantially. I'm afraid that this system of using conservation credits to destroy invaluable habitats is just a way of turning wildlife into a tradable commodity with complex markets that could be exploited by developers and bankers alike. It would inevitably lead to a lack of transparency, and implementing the trials would mark the start of a slippery slope into the negotiation of numerous murky deals.
I can assure you that everything will be above board. Details will be made available to the public, as they have been in the recent well-publicised deal, in which developers will provide the £5 million so desperately needed to give a fortress used in the Napoleonic Wars a makeover, in return for permits to build a 5-star hotel and 500 houses. The fortress is part of our national heritage, which we developers will help retain for future generations. We're adopting a long-term view, which environmentalists seem incapable of doing. Take what we did in the 1980s, when we transported the earth, dug from the Channel Tunnel to an area near the White Cliffs of Dover. Environmentalists criticised the idea at the time in exactly the same way as they are attacking these trials. Now, 3 decades later, the area known as Sapphire Ho Nature Reserve attracts over 100,000 visitors every year.
Now you will hear part 3 again.
As the global population grows, a greater strain is being put on the planet to provide for humankind. Very often, the struggle to improve standards of living results in having to decide whether to exploit an area of natural beauty for its resources or leave nature alone. Here to discuss the issue of money versus the environment are developer Fay Manya and environmentalist Peter Green. Fay, could you tell us how you can put a price on the environment?
First of all, I'd like to establish a level playing field for this discussion by dispelling the notion that developers are the ruthless, insensitive individuals portrayed in the media. I think that the newly announced government plans to put a price on wildlife clearly shows that developers are now considered responsible, and the idea that developers just want to use nature for their own ends is definitely a thing of the past. The initial trial will involve 6 local authorities putting a price of, say, 40 conservation credits on every 10 homes developed. Each credit could be worth £2,500, making a total of £100,000 to a broker who commissions another landowner to convert fields or scrublands into meadows or woodlands to offset the developed land. The remaining money is then paid to this landowner to maintain wildlife for 2 to 3 decades.
I'm afraid I'm a lot less enthusiastic about the government plan than you are. The plan has been drawn up without sufficient research into the type of artificial environment that would substitute for the site torn up by developers. How, for example, can you think it's acceptable to tear down existing woodland? One would have to wait at least a decade for new woods to grow to be considered a replacement. In fact, it is highly unlikely that any artificial environment will be able to support as many different species as one that has developed naturally. I really feel that the whole idea of creating a new currency in the form of the conservation credit is simply a way for developers to evade planning rules and to gain access to prime greenfield sites so that they can make huge profits.
I think you're missing the point of the proposal trials. We shouldn't need to choose between either improving the environment or growing the economy. We should aim to do both, and these trials should lead to ways of achieving this. And it is not simply a case of satisfying the wants of developers, as you have suggested. It is more a case of meeting needs. There is a parallel in Brazil, where near the town of Carjás, in the middle of the Amazon jungle, lies a vast iron ore mine. From the profits raised, the quality of life for the residents of Rio's favelas or slum areas has been improved. 20 years ago, these slums were neglected because they weren't considered important. Now, perhaps because of global attention being drawn to Rio de Janeiro through sporting events, improving the reputation of the city is top of the agenda. It's a case of moving with the times.
But this comes at a cost. Once a specific environment has been developed, there is no going back. Species disappear. England is losing its wildlife at an alarming rate. Every taxa of birds, butterflies and bees has declined by around 40%, and the country has lost 500 species in the last 200 years. With these trials, losses would accelerate substantially. I'm afraid that this system of using conservation credits to destroy invaluable habitats is just a way of turning wildlife into a tradable commodity with complex markets that could be exploited by developers and bankers alike. It would inevitably lead to a lack of transparency, and implementing the trials would mark the start of a slippery slope into the negotiation of numerous murky deals.
I can assure you that everything will be above board. Details will be made available to the public, as they have been in the recent well-publicised deal in which developers will provide the £5 million so desperately needed to give a fortress used in the Napoleonic Wars a makeover in return for permits to build a 5-star hotel and 500 houses. The fortress is part of our national heritage, which we developers will help retain for future generations. We're adopting a long-term view, which environmentalists seem incapable of doing. Take what we did in the 1980s, when we transported the earth dug from the Channel Tunnel to an area near the White Cliffs of Dover. Environmentalists criticised the idea at the time in exactly the same way as they are attacking these trials. Now, 3 decades later, the area known as Sapphire Ho Nature Reserve attracts over 100,000 visitors every year.
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4.
Part 4. You're going to listen to the final recording. Again, before you listen, you'll have 20 seconds to read the instruction carefully. And you'll listen to the piece twice.
Excitement has been building up ahead of Apple's latest event that kicked off just a short while ago. And for good reason, too. The company just unveiled its most ambitious product in years. It's, wait for it, a headset that lets people experience both virtual and augmented reality. It does that by overlaying virtual images and apps on the real world. I want to bring in John Sarlin, the host of Nightcap over at CNN Business. And John, I was hearing they've just announced that in the last few minutes, the most significant product launch in nearly a decade. So what do you make of this new product, this mixed reality headset?
That's right, Issa. Moments ago, Apple CEO Tim Cook announcing Vision Pro, the new product from Apple. This is their biggest new hardware since the Apple Watch, and it's Apple's first foray into AR, augmented reality. So we know virtual reality, a screen in your face, this is something that you see through, like a aluminum ski goggles on your head that melds the real world with the virtual world.
Okay, so how is this different, John, than playing a video, a virtual reality video game? Just bring us, you know, give us the vision here from Tim Cook in terms of the future of how we could be using this. Because this thing looks like it'll be perfect for skiing.
Right, so I mean, up to this point, VR has kind of been a niche product. You mentioned gaming. That's really been one of the big use cases, but Apple is going for the mainstream consumer here. They're going for fitness, they're going for FaceTime, they're going for productivity, and they're looking to expand the pool from beyond that just niche gaming space.
Yes, but the price tag, John, it leaves a lot to be desired. What I'd read, and maybe you heard it there, I heard something like $3,000. How much will this be a tough sell, you think, for consumers here?
Right, so they still haven't announced the price, but that is the big question, right? Rumors are that it should be around $3,000. That's a lot of money. The closest competition here is Meta's Oculus headset. That costs a few hundred dollars. So Apple is taking a big risk here with this product where their demand isn't really proven, but also going from on a price point that is way beyond what's currently on the market.
And very quickly, I know that Tim Cook was expected to talk about Apple's strategy and what relates to AI. Did we hear anything? Has he spoken about this?
So far, nothing explicitly AI, although there have been some updates on autocorrect. If you've used an iPhone, you know how difficult that can be. But, you know, right now I'm in Silicon Valley. Virtually every tech company is focusing on AI. Google recently in their annual event focused almost entirely AI. So a lot of questions about how Apple will directly integrate it into their software.
And very quickly, yes or no, do you see this headset taking off, John, at all?
Well, look, this is a huge risk for Apple, right? I mean, think of what Apple does with their products. Usually they wait for a product to be in the market for a few years and then come out with their version, which they hope to be the best. It's been a very successful strategy with AirPhones, with AirPods, all the way back to the iPhone, to iPods. This is a market that hasn't really been proven yet. Consumers haven't shown an inclination for putting a big expensive thing on top of their head and stepping into the virtual world. But you know Apple, they don't have a lot of misses. So Tim Cook and co. are worked hard on this device. We'll see if consumers line up to get it.
Yeah, I know that others have tried it, haven't actually done well at it. Let's see if Apple succeeds where others have failed. John Sarlin, appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Now listen again.
This audio is made with Audio Toolkit for Windows Store. Downloaded for free now.
Excitement has been building up ahead of Apple's latest event that kicked off just a short while ago. And for good reason, too. The company just unveiled its most ambitious product in years. It's, wait for it, a headset that lets people experience both virtual and augmented reality. Does that by overlaying virtual images and apps on the real world. I want to bring in John Sarlin, the host of Nightcap over at CNN Business. And John, I was hearing they've just announced that in the last few minutes, the most significant product launch in nearly a decade. So what do you make of this new product, this mixed reality headset?
That's right, Issa. Moments ago, Apple CEO Tim Cook announcing Vision Pro, the new product from Apple. This is their biggest new hardware since the Apple Watch, and it's Apple's first foray into AR, augmented reality. So we know virtual reality, a screen in your face, this is something that you see through, like a aluminum ski goggles on your head that melds the real world with the virtual world.
Okay, so how is this different, John, than playing a virtual reality video game? Just bring us, you know, give us the vision here from Tim Cook in terms of the future of how we could be using this. Because this thing looks like it'll be perfect for skiing.
Right, so I mean, up to this point, VR has kind of been a niche product. You mentioned gaming. That's really been one of the big use cases, but Apple is going for the mainstream consumer here. They're going for fitness, they're going for FaceTime, they're going for productivity, and they're looking to expand the pool from beyond that just niche gaming space.
Yes, but the price tag, John, it leaves a lot to be desired. What I'd read, and maybe you heard it there, I heard something like $3,000. How much will this be a tough sell, you think, for consumers here?
Right, so they still haven't announced the price, but that is the big question, right? Rumors are that it should be around $3,000. That's a lot of money. The closest competition here is Oculus's, Meta's Oculus headset. That costs a few hundred dollars. So Apple is taking a big risk here with this product where their demand isn't really proven, but also going from on a price point that is way beyond what's currently on the market.
And very quickly, I know that Tim Cook was expected to talk about Apple's strategy and what relates to AI. Did we hear anything? Has he spoken about this?
So far, nothing explicitly AI, although there have been some updates on autocorrect. If you've used an iPhone, you know how difficult that can be. But, you know, right now I'm in Silicon Valley. Virtually every tech company is focusing on AI. Google recently in their annual event focused almost entirely AI. So a lot of questions about how Apple will directly integrate it into their software.
And very quickly, yes or no, do you see this headset taking off, John, at all?
Well, look, this is a huge risk for Apple, right? I mean, think of what Apple does with their products. Usually they wait for a product to be in the market for a few years and then come out with their version, which they hope to be the best. It's been a very successful strategy with AirPhones, with AirPods, all the way back to the iPhone, to iPods. This is a market that hasn't really been proven yet. Consumers haven't shown an inclination for putting a big expensive thing on top of their head and stepping into the virtual world. But you know Apple, they don't have a lot of misses. So Tim Cook and co. are worked hard on this device. We'll see if consumers line up to get it.
Yeah, I know that others have tried it, haven't actually done well at it. Let's see if Apple succeeds where others have failed. John Sarlin, appreciate it. Thanks very much.
That's the end of the listening section. You now have 2 minutes to check all your answers.